The reason that I've been talking with you about Buddhism and Buddhist views of the self is that they're really somewhat unique in world religions. And the way Buddhists view the idea of the self or the ego, for one thing, is unique. And the implications of their view are also unique. And this way that they view the self fits in very well with Whitmont's ideas and his concerns in ways that he wasn't actually aware of. And I think which he would have found very interesting. So to do a little bit of a recap for you, and going back to this little chart that we have, as you'll recall from the earlier talk that I did, the Buddhist view of the person and the nature of the person is based upon observation. It's almost like what we would call experiment. The old Buddhist meditators looked very closely at their internal state. The Buddha himself did that, which is how he became the Buddha. I won't even try and explain that right now. And they understood that the person was made up of many parts, but those many parts could be categorized into parts that were similar, and that understanding those similarities were important. And that's how they came up with this idea of the five aggregates, that matter and habits are really quite different than each other. Even though they mutually influence each other, they're still experientially very different than each other. Now, the main idea that they came up with that I want you to understand, and that's relevant to this class, is that in this whole complex, the idea of the self, or I, was something that they determined to be a label. Now, most people, when you think of yourself, I, you think of yourself as if you're a thing. Maybe you're like a little thing inside your body. In psychological terms, that's called a homunculus. Or a little, like a little rider inside the body in some way, or a soul inside your body. This would be a very typical Christian view, that what I really am is a soul that somehow inhabits the body. When the body dies, the soul somehow comes out of it in some way and sticks around, goes to heaven, or maybe goes to some in-between place until there's a resurrection. I mean, there are a number of ways in Christian theology to think about this, but the basic idea is that the real you is inside the body, that somehow the body isn't the real you. But the main point is that the real you is a real thing in that it's permanent. It can't be divided up. It's unique to you. Your soul, David, and Forrest's soul are just different. They're absolutely different. They may share some features, like they're immortal. Temporarily, they're resident in the body. This is, again, the Christian view. Okay. But the two souls are radically different from each other. And in fact, depending upon how you live life, different things could happen to those two souls. You know, one could go to heaven, one might not, or whatever. There are all kinds of permutations based upon three options, one of which is a temporary option, which was invented later in Christian history, called limbo. So that's not unusual in the world, actually. Many religious perspectives are that there's something like a soul inside of a person which is permanent. It's primal. Many primal religions have this view, although there are other views. That's a very typical view in India, although the idea is not that you die and go to heaven, but that you die and come back here. Reincarnation isn't considered a very good thing, but it is the view in India. As I often joke to people, who would ever want to go to high school again? It sounds pretty horrible to me. I didn't have much fun in high school. Anyway, that aside, the Buddhist view was very different. The Buddhist view was that what experiences itself as what is called a soul in other traditions, or might be called an ego or a self in Western language, is just mere consciousness, which is observing what's going on, and nothing more than that. But the reason that that mere consciousness feels like an I is because there's labeling and thinking involved. So the thought, I, arises in consciousness and is applied to or designated on, to use the Buddhist language, the complex of mind and body. And a traditional example in Buddhism was the story of the monk Nagasena, who was a very famous monk in Northwest India. And Northwest India at the time was actually, in his time, culturally was under the influence of kings who were the successors of Alexander the Great, who, as you may recall, conquered through the area of now north of Afghanistan, and then came down through the Khyber Pass into what's now Pakistan. Anyhow, he left kingdoms behind, and in these kingdoms, what the kings would do to demonstrate that they were sophisticated, that they weren't mere yokels, rather, was they would have a court philosopher. So philosophy was something that happened in the royal court as a form of entertainment, among other things, right? So in this one particular kingdom, the king hears about this great Buddhist philosopher, saint practitioner, Nagasena, and he goes out to visit him, which was unusual in itself. Usually everybody came to see the king. So he rides out to see Nagasena, and he says, "So I hear you really know a lot. What's the big deal?" Essentially, obviously they don't say things like that, but that's, you know. And so Nagasena says, "Well, okay, you sure you want the answer?" Along these lines. And the king says, "Well, of course I do." And the king says, "Yeah." And so Nagasena then leads him into this line of thought. And the line of thought is, "Look, you say you came here on a chariot, right?" And the king says, "Well, of course. I don't walk. I'm a king." And he says, "Well, okay, look, is the chariot in the wheels?" And the king says, "No." "Is the chariot in the yoke?" "No." "Is the chariot in the horses?" "No." "Is the chariot in the platform that you sit on?" "No." "Is it in the reins?" "No." And then Nagasena says, "Well, Mr. King, I just asked you a pretty simple question. Where's the chariot? You haven't been able to answer that. I mean, you could lose your head for saying things like this under most circumstances." The king says, "Well, it's in all those things together." And so the Nagasena says, "Okay, so basically what a chariot is a whole bunch of parts that have been hung together and labeled with the word chariot, right?" And the king says, "Yeah, that's pretty much it. Because if you start pulling the parts apart, or if you don't label it correctly in some way, it's not a chariot. I mean, what's the difference between a chariot and an ox cart? You know, I mean, fundamentally, in the way they work, in the way they're built, they're pretty similar. I mean, there are differences, of course. One's heavy, one's light, one's pulled by horses, another by oxen. One has spoked wheels, the other one doesn't, like that. But fundamentally, they're the same thing." So the king says, "Yeah, you're right. Okay, I get it, right? A chariot is just all these parts that hang together with a label chariot." And Nagasena then says, "Well, that's what a king is too, you. I mean, kings, you know, they think they're a big deal." And he says, "No, look, you're your body, you're your perceptions, you're the son of somebody, so you're dependent upon certain causes," and he goes through this whole thing. "Plus, you think me king. Put all those things together and you've got a king. Anything missing, there's no king." But the main point was that king is a label applied to this body, just like you are a label applied to the body. I'll give you a more modern example. George W. Bush, okay? Very, very powerful person up until the inauguration of Barack Obama, right? One morning, he's the leader of the free world. He can blow the world up if he wants to. He can shift vast amounts of money and people from one place to another. That afternoon, he's nada, except he's got Secret Service around him, but he has no power at all. At the end of the Clinton administration, these guys were funny. At the end of the Clinton administration, they did the equivalent of a home movie. And they have Clinton before the inauguration of Bush and all this kind of stuff's going on. And his last day in the White House, he has to make a sandwich himself, put it in a paper bag. He walks out the front door, and the limo drives away without him. He's standing there like, "Whoa, what's going on?" This was their message about power. Very interesting. And about the meaning of president. President is designated on a person. So by this Buddhist view, David is David and knows himself as David because he designates, and everybody else designates, the label David on him. More importantly, the sense of I, the sense of self, is built up over time. and is designated on the body mind. If you can remember what it was like to be 5, 6, 7 years old, if you can remember being that age and remember your experiences of that age, probably what you remember is experiencing the world, but your whole sense of I was very, very different. Now, I can actually remember one particular experience along these lines after all these years. So that's now over 60, that's 60 years ago now, but I still remember this experience because it's very powerful. I'm a little kid, probably 7 years old, maybe 6. I'm playing in a vacant lot in Southern California, probably in the late spring because the grass was very tall and green and fresh smelling. Okay, so this is what I can remember. I mean, tall by my standards because I was pretty short, but anyhow, very tall. And I remember it very distinctly. And I remember my experience very distinctly, not just the grass. My experience was experience of the grass and the smell and the clarity and experience of the mildness of the air. But there was no experience of me as a subject having that experience. And I can still remember that. If you could remember being 6 or 7, that's what you would remember. Because according to psychologists, your ego hasn't been fully formed to the point where everything runs through the sense of I when you have the experience. Now, we have no experience except running it through the sense of I. So Buddhists are saying that I is designated on this complex, and that's all it is, that there's no solid thing there. There's no solid thing there. So this is a kind of a radical example, or a radical idea, rather, in the context of religious thought. Now, the reason this is important from a religious point of view is if I can be designated, if all I is a label that's designated onto the complex of body-mind and all that's contained therein, you can designate any label you want onto the body-mind. That's mutable, that's subject to change. Just like president is designated on the body of Bill Clinton for an 8-year period, but no longer. Or president is designated on the body or the personality or the body-mind of George W. Bush for 8 years and no longer. Sometimes we sloppily say President Bush. Technically, he's ex-President Bush. But he doesn't have the powers of a president anymore. Okay. So the real meaning of president is something we designate on a person based upon certain circumstances, and that can be changed. If Bill Clinton is elected president of the World Bank for some reason, he has a new set of powers that he didn't have as president of the United States, and a new identity and a new function in the world in relationship to people. Right? So if you change the designation of you upon yourself, from the Buddhist point of view, you will be different over time because the designation makes you be in a certain way. See, the designation David on me is associated with the idea of being a professor, of being an ordinary person of a certain age, and so on and so forth. But if I were to designate some other set of ideas on myself, that would make me be a different person. Now that sounds a little radical, I think, in some respects. But if you actually look at this huge market for self-help books in the United States, which is a vast market, you can make a lot of money this way, and a lot of people do make a lot of money this way. So this is not a trivial phenomenon. Anything that's worth billions of dollars in the U.S. economy is not trivial. Almost all of the self-help books boil down to the same thing. Affirmations and thinking of yourself as being something other than what you think of yourself as being. Because if you think of yourself as being in a certain way, there are limitations that are associated with that. And if you think of yourself as not having those limitations, according to the self-help books, then you don't have those limitations anymore. Okay. So according to the psychoanalytic theory, say to go to that level, right? there are parts of yourself that you accept and parts of yourself that you don't accept, and that's what's in your unconscious, that's what's in your shadow, to use the Jungian language. If you choose to be a different person, you just decide you're going to be a different person, and you practice this over a long period of time, then you are deciding that some things you'll be conscious of and other things you won't be conscious of, and therefore your experience changes as a result of that. That's actually part of the principle of psychoanalytic therapy, is to alter what the ego accepts and rejects for the person, for your personhood. So the Buddhists understood this idea. Now, in their realm, and the things that they were concerned about, what they cared about, was what is it about the person that makes them unhappy? I mean, this is the core issue in the way the Buddha taught. What was it about the person that makes the person unhappy? Right. So their view on how do you alter that problem was complex, but one of the things that you did to alter that was you changed the designation of who or what I am. And they did it with images, and this is how it links to the Jungian material. They didn't just think, hey, look, I'm a this. Now I want to be a that. They didn't just think it. They recognized that the power of the way the subconscious mind works was it works through images. So the way you change your relationship to the subconscious mind, to the mythic level of yourself, is you change the self-image, to introduce that kind of language. If you change your self-image, you change yourself, and you change your experience. And if you're seeking a certain kind of religious experience, and if you're seeking integration, completeness, to use the Jungian language, then if you designate an image onto yourself which is different than the one you currently designate, you will be different. So now think for a minute. Think about this as sort of a thought experiment. When you think I, if Forrest thinks I, if David thinks I, as Alex thinks I, as Tori thinks I, is there an image that comes up? Think about this. When you think I, is there an image associated with it? Okay, David, what is the image?
Oh, I was just going to say I'm missing my throne and my crown.
Okay. There's the image of what David wants to be. David wants to be the biblical David, right? Okay. But the current image of David, or the current image of Forrest or Tori, what is your sense of yourself? When you have that sense of I experiencing things, what does that I look like?
Not so much an image.
Okay.
It's more like a grouping of feelings, both negative and positive.
And feelings means what kind of feelings means? What do you mean by feelings? Negative and positive feelings?
Like groupings of associations, I guess.
Like from past experiences,
yeah,
that kind
like
of thing.
What am I? Who am I? Well, I am what I think I am, right?
Right.
And what I think I am is mostly just not thoughts. It's mostly like feelings.
Okay. Are there physical feelings associated with that?
What do you mean?
Like your body. Like when you were smaller at one point, when you were a child, right? You may have weighed less, or sometimes maybe you're exercising more and you're feeling tired. I mean, are those kinds of feelings, are those things associated with the self-image in any way?
No, I suppose not.
Anybody? See, here's the reason I asked this question, since nobody's really answering it. So I'll just sort of put it out there anyway. My experience of me as I, when I'm sort of sitting inside here and sort of checking out what does the I feel like that's experiencing things like this, and I really look closely at that subject, there is a kind of an awareness there. But the awareness has a kind of a coloration or a tone to it that I associate with me. And if I look very closely at it, for one thing, the sound of my name is actually in there. The sound David is actually in there. As if And the reason I can say this is, again, I'll share my own experience. When I first graduated from college, the first job I had was selling clothing in a small clothing store in the college town that I lived in. But when I interviewed for the job, the people who were doing the interview said, "We can't hire you even though we think you're qualified. Why is that?" I said, "Well, your name," they said, "Well, your name is David. My name is David, and the other guy who's on the floor is called David, and having three Davids on the floor at the same time selling clothing is just going to be too confusing." I said, "Fine, I have a middle name. It's Ross. Call me Ross, and then you can give me the job." And they said, "Oh, okay." These are brilliant people, right? Okay. So for a year and a half, I wasn't David at work. I was Ross. And that was a very interesting experience because my whole sense of I as Ross was a somewhat different personality than my whole sense of I as David. I actually felt different. Okay. So then here's something else to think about. I have a very bad habit, so I'll use my own example, so I'm sorry about this. It's not like I think I'm the center of everything, but this is my experience. Well, I am the center of everything for me, right? We're all the center of everything. Well, there's a Buddhist thing I'll get to about that in just a minute. I have this very bad habit of clenching my jaw. That's where my stress goes, into my jaw, and I clench my jaw a lot. And so this morning when I woke up, my teeth hurt. Something was bothering me from last night. And so I woke up and my teeth hurt because I was clenching my jaw so much. The consequence of that over the years is the muscles on the side of my head, especially my jaw muscles, but all up and down the side of my skull, are distorted and tight in a certain kind of a way. There's a whole lot of stress in those muscles. And it's there in my experience all the time. But I don't necessarily notice it. But if I really settle into looking at my own internal experience, that stress is part of what defines the subject, David, in relationship to all the elements of object. And one of the ways I can recognize this is sometimes I've had a massage with somebody who was very good at alleviating that tension. And when that happened, almost a panic mode would arise because I wouldn't have the sense of me as being me anymore. Because I felt so like somebody not me, because me was so associated with those kinds of tensions in my organic system that I didn't feel like me anymore. Okay. So I'm using these as examples of the way in which we have subtle ways of defining and designating the sense of I onto this complex. And at some level, it's about image. At some level, it's about physical feeling. In some level, it's about concept. And they're not really the same thing. Okay. The word David and everything associated with David, David who is Dr. David, David who is Professor David, those are intellectual things. Okay. David who's defined by the stress in his jaw, that's physical, that's organic. David who's defined by a self-image of, I'm still the skinny kid that I was a long time ago, even though I wear a size large now. But, you know, I used to be a real skinny kid. The physical image that I have of myself is still a skinny kid. And every time I look in a mirror and see this guy who's bald on top with gray hair and is anything but skinny, there is a disconnect in what I see and what I know myself to be. I told you the story about the models and the fashion show, right? It's the same kind of thing, right? It's that the image that we have of ourselves is not the image anybody else has of us. There's a disconnect. So those three levels of experience define ourselves, and I pick those three levels because that's what Whitmott is focusing on. Sort of the organic physiological, the dreaming, if you will, imagistic mythical mind, and the rational analytical conceptual verbal mind. All those things come together to create the sense of I. So what the Buddhists say, though, is that that's amenable to change. So if the Jungian view is that completeness or integration is what's desired as part of the religious goal, because we're fragmented as individuals. We grow up fragmented, cultures fragment us, and what religious life is about reintegrating ourselves, then dealing with this image is part of the way in which we reintegrate ourselves. And this is what I wanted to lead up to. As I said earlier, I felt like I got these things backwards. Ooh.